Today, it's Edwin's Monday Evening Property Rant. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. It's Monday evening, and I have a slow Edwin with me. Hi, Edwin. How are you doing?
Very slow. I'm just taking it easy, Martin.
Well, you're obviously observing the signs. That's what I like to see.
Yeah, go slow. Go slow. We're approaching Christmas, so there's a lot of things to consider before you jump in on the market, you know, from anything. But the only thing you've got to be quick at, is locking in those long-term leases, Martin. You know, it's lock and load for those leases because it's only going to get more painful for tenants, unfortunately. That's, and it's only going to get more concerning well into 2023.
Well, it's interesting because the RBA released their monetary policy statement on Friday, and that was inflation will be higher, interest rates will be higher, wages growth will be below trend for quite a long time, and there are lots of uncertainties. There you go. So nothing in this world is certain.
Well, there are a number of things that you can be certain, apart from death and taxes. Energy costs and the fact that the politicians are raking it in at the moment, that's a certain there. And I'm just going to put it out there. I'm going to be a conspiracy theorist right now. But I reckon they'll get, I'd say about a 5% raise next year. The politicians, they work so hard.
Well, you know, that we are so lucky to have the politicians we do, and they obviously aren't being paid enough to do what they do. So, you know, it's clearly that they should be paid a lot more, despite the fact everybody else is being paid less in real terms. But, hey, I actually think the analogy of reversing a truck up a very narrow street is actually quite a good one for the RBA, except I think that I've got more confidence in this driver from the video that you took than I have for the RBA.
Definitely. It's a sign of the economy, I think, as well, coming backwards. It's interesting. Like, yeah, just before that, as I attended that auction where I took that video, I actually parked on the other side of the street, and I've got a four-wheel drive, a dual cab, and I was sort of stuck out a little bit, and I thought, gee, this is pretty tight. And not expecting to see this when something inside me told me, don't park here, go elsewhere. So I did. I went around the corner and I parked there. So, yeah, you just got to go slow, listen to your intuition and be wise with your decisions. Don't take those risks that we could have taken in 2019 or even as early as 2020. But look, there's a lot of things changing. There's a lot of things going to change, and the world is going to get more and more interesting into 2023. But there were two people talking about it back in 2020, how things were going to unfold. I don't know who that could be. Do you have any idea, Martin, who that might have been?
You mean a couple of people on a certain channel talking about property and related things?
Yeah, property related things. Yeah. Things over in China, the WeChat chatter.
Yeah. I mean, it's on one hand, it's quite nice to be ahead of the curve, but on the other hand, it's not a curve that I really want to be ahead of, if you know what I mean.
No, you could almost think it's a curse. But look, it's you can keep you out of trouble, but it can also get you into trouble. But we also we're going to speak a little bit more about Xi and what's happening over in China. And we said a couple of months ago that what his intentions were if he took the reins for the third term, and he was going to be El Comandante for life, the Emperor for life. And it is what it is now, and now it's official. I mean, he's already talking about sharing the wealth. It's the Commonwealth, as he calls it. It's a Commonwealth movement. I mean, he's done away with Deng's policy over up and out to the west, and we're going to talk about what that means and the implications of that and what it means to the local economy there and more importantly, what it means to us in the property sector and so forth. And things get wackier even locally with live auctions. And I'm not talking about the auction over at Granville. The live televised auctions, on TV and what happened there. It's just an absolute fizzer. but it's a an indication, and it's the reality of what happens with marketing campaigns. And while people have just got to be careful as to what strategies they take, we're going to open that up. And lo and behold, we will talk about the wacky world of our Granville auction and the viewer submission as well.
Yeah, and we might even talk about the block on the way past. I think we should probably touch on that. But before we get into that, let's just reflect on what you said, because you threw a quick comment in right at the front about long-term leases, and it's worth just reflecting on that slightly more, isn't it?
Look, it is, and this is where the pain's going to really start to come to pass. I mean, Pete put out a tweet this morning, and I was at a quick glance at it. It's rather interesting. And this is where I just put out there. I said, look, locking long leases, folks, because the pain's going to get harder, as you and I've been talking about. Any changes, any policy changes, or any fundamental, not only policy but actual physical changes to the landscape of the property arena, meaning when something is actually approved to be developed and completed, it'll take anywhere between 2 and 3 years. So we're expected to, the local renters and the local Aussies are expected to bear this pain that's about to come for the next 2 to 3 years before things change, as you and I've been talking about for a long time now. Whether it was the Libs or the Labs, we're going to open up the migration borders, whether it be for what people may think it's a good thing to bring in migrants or short-term stays and students and the like. But at the end of the day, we end up with what you and I have been calling for a number of years now, the ghost migrants, the people that overstay their visas, and obviously they're going to bunk up, and the government's only made it easier and more attractive for them to come along. And hence the reason why they're coming along. And this batch of people that have come now, let's understand one thing. And these aren't necessarily the people that will share the 6 person per two bedroom apartment accommodation. These are people that are somewhat a bit more affluent, and they've paid a lot more to travel to Australia, but also with for various reasons, whether it be tourists, whether it be backpacking, whether it be backpacking as well as work, and the policy around that change where these backpackers and tourists could actually obtain work lawfully, and they come to Australia. At the end of the day, we've always said that Australia is a great country not only to visit but to live in, and this is what we got. The next group of people are going to be the ones that are going to be staying longer term. The question is, we know one thing: the policy changes around immigration and visas has been softened. They started softening that, diluting that in 2019, even before the pandemic, before it all started. And now there's this call that we need more migrants all of a sudden in order to boost up the economy and so forth. I mean, juggle one ball, juggle a fiery knife or whatever you want to juggle. The government just seems to be juggling things and, telling us all sorts of things that we're meant to believe as to what's going to change the economy and we're going to have a better outcome. But at the end of the day, it puts a lot of pressure on the local, on the local renters, on the local Aussies. And this is what I'm saying is that next year, the next group of people that are going to be coming in en masse are the people that are going to be staying and taking up your apartment accommodations, your other types, anything available, even your room lettings that are just going to be in high need. Now this is where I have an issue with these government policies, and this is where the landlords or the owners of properties look. Let's face it, rentals are capped to a certain point, but if you want to break that ceiling, you convert your rental property from a normal rental per se to, as I call them, an illegal boarding house or a shared accommodation where you're going to get your leasing it per room. And this is the issue, and this is where, regardless of what, even if the great things in announcing new policies, new changes, building a million, build 2 million, build 3 million, whatever. It's still going to take 2 to 3, even 4 years for those properties to be set in concrete, you could say, and for people to start taking advantage of it. And what are the people meant to do meantime?
Yeah, that's right. There was a capacity issue, and it's just worth underscoring that the growth lever of bringing more people in, it sort of only increases the total count. It doesn't necessarily increase the growth per capita, which is the real measure. And we've seen over the last 15 to 20 years that just throwing more people on the problem creates more congestion, puts more pressure on prices, but doesn't actually necessarily solve anything. But anyway, it's the only recipe that they've got, as we've discussed on numerous occasions. So for those people thinking of positioning in the renting sector, worth taking account of what we think is coming down the tubes, I suppose.
Yeah, look, and just to finish off on this topic is, look, the 12-month lease, 6 or a 12-month lease, are not the only options available. In New South Wales, you can negotiate up to 3 years without getting, NCAT or Fair Trade New South Wales involved. Anything beyond that, you'll have to make special submissions. But you can negotiate a 3-year lease without having to make a special application to NCAT because the tribunal. So don't be fooled by thinking that you can only do a 6-month lease or a 12-month lease. That's not the case.
Yep. Good point, Edwin. Absolutely good point. Now we should move on and talk about the auction of 2022, huh?
That's it. It's the auction. I'm calling it the auction of 2022. This is a view submission. It's admitted that listing, and so happened that I'd know the agency and an agency in that office, and we're able to get some background information. But the interesting thing there is, Martin, the hedonic put that actual potential sale at $650,000. That's the back end of CoreLogic. That was rather interesting. That's a bit above $3,000 per square meter for that block of land. The agent was guiding 320. Be fair, he was guiding 320 to 350, and and I thought the reserve was going to be set around the 275, to be honest with you. But strangely enough, we find out in the videos that you may play and further. I posted that tweet I pinned that on my Twitter handle, and people can go and get the full story as to what happened. The different videos that we put up there, which you'll share, and other commentary there. But it's all. And it sold for the reserve. The reserve was actually set by Interval Energy at lo and behold, $360,000.
Yes, and it is actually quite interesting when you look at the videos and you understand what it is. Friendly dog next door, a large power substation in the front garden, a single square thing. And correct me if I'm wrong, Edwin, but they're not allowed to actually knock the whole thing down, are they?
Oh, look, you can. You can build it. The thing is, it's in the cost, right? So there are a number of things that you have to keep in mind. You can't lock that substation, that green box that's at the front there. You can't lock that up. It's got to be accessible 24/7 to Integral Energy. So there's an easement on that, right? So talking to a builder, a very good builder, and he showed me the actual plans of why he wanted it and what he wanted to do with it. And it was rather elaborate, the plans. You take advantage of the original structure that's there, because it's solid. That
thing ain't going built anywhere. Like a tank.
built like a nuclear bunker, But then again, Martin, who knows? Maybe that's why the
it could be useful.
So you use it, and you can actually go. You can actually build up to 9 meters on that dwelling, on that property. So 9 meters high. So you could literally. It'll be a very interesting. I mean, the plans were very elaborate. The one that the builder showed me on the day, and it was going to be three levels. It was going to look funky, but at the end of the day, like, you sort of think you can only do it if you're an owner builder. I mean, he was a builder, so. But if somebody bought it to get employer builder to build it. It was just, it just didn't make any, it didn't make sense. There were other things that you couldn't do to the property. You couldn't put any windows at the front. The front doors have to be fire rated, because if anything happens to the green substation there at the front, I mean, obviously, you got to have, you got to be protected. You can't put windows to the side. So all these other inherent issues. So at the end of the day, really what you've got is you've got 177 square meters of land, less, 17, 18 square meters or even more for the, for the substation that you're going to lose. And that's it. So yeah, you're talking 2,300 per square meter of land that you bought, and then plus the cost to build. It's just gonna you're better off buying a fibre house around the corner on 550 square meters. You get more bang for your buck that way. But it is what it is, and we will talk about the wacky. Yeah, what's wackier than a conspiracy theory? We'll bring out a little bit more as to who bought it and how they came about to buy it.
Okay, yeah, well, I was going to say, when you were talking about nine, I was thinking, are you going to talk about nine stories? And then you said nine meters. So, phew, at least it's not going to be nine stories high, right?
9 meters, well, that's three levels.
Yeah. That's still pretty amazing. Yeah, okay, very good. Well, we should get on and talk about WeChat chatters, and it's just worth underscoring, isn't it, that there was a lot of shenanigans last week post Xi's, reappointment or appointment or confirmation about the COVID lockdowns, right? Because there was a lot of rumours, particularly put out by Western media, that the plans are to reduce COVID lockdowns next year. But in fact, now those pretty much have been scotched by the people in the country and within China. So no real change.
No real change. Well, other than the fact that the main change is, it's now public. It's being announced. You and I spoke about it, Jacqueline. We said, welcome to Mao 2.0. The Cultural Revolution 2.0. But look, Xi's put it out there that he wants a commonwealth. He wants a sharing of wealth. He's going back to, he's done away with Deng's policy of opening up to the West, 40 years of opening up to the West and growing, spreading their wings. Now it's all coming back. One of the main things, one of the first things that the WeChat chatter has told us about is the fact that, Tencent, WeChat, and now formally getting into a joint venture with China Telecom. So that's basically the state owned operation moving into the private sector. We're going to see a lot more of that. It's going to be interesting to see how many of overseas investment groups are going to withdraw their interest in Chinese Chinese shares because with this sharing of Xi's sharing of wealth or commonwealth, it basically comes down to what he wants is the ones that have to share with the have nots. So it's going to be, as he calls it, it's going to be a we would call it a redistribution of wealth. We would call it communism. But they call it donations. They're going to be asking the big corporations to donate to those that don't have. So that's what we're going to go back into. It's going to be interesting how that's all going to unfold and what it's going to mean to the Western economies that are relying on China for materials, base materials, and for finished products. Because right now, Guangzhou is in lockdown, and as I understand it, some of the villages in Guangzhou, entire villages in Guangzhou, are being transported away into COVID camps. So that's how serious that's how they're basically taking the zero policy there, and whether it be call it control, call it whatever you want to call it. Yeah, at the end of the day, it's really politics aside, whatever they want to do aside there. At the end of the day, what it means for us is that supply chains we're going to go back to all those issues again. People that are thinking of building and people that are bought, house and land and house packages, what's going to happen to those? Our builders are going to be in future in more stress. That's just going to continue. It's going to continue to roll well into 2023.
Yes, Edwin, and it's going to be quite broad based, I think. And as I said earlier on, it was interesting that the Western media were pushing very hard the view that it was going to open up next year and everything will be fine. And in fact, the markets reacted quite positively. So we suddenly saw the price of some of the metals go up and oil go up and those things, all on the back of that rumor, right? It just shows you how disconnected sometimes the Western media is from what's going on within China, because you and I have been saying for some little time that there's another agenda there, and it's now playing out as we expected.
Yeah, look, there was always going to be a tussle between Li and Xi, but Xi put out what he wanted, what he really wanted to go with, and we spoke about it a couple of months ago, or a bit over a couple of months ago. We briefly mentioned that. And that was the redistribution of the wealth, the Commonwealth of China. Now it's official. I mean, it's not like he withheld any, like he hid any of it. He's the emperor forever now, and that's it. And the Western world now have to live with it. It's going to be interesting, to see what Europe does. With issues that they're going to be facing, and also with regards to, to America, because obviously, it's going to have huge ramifications around the world. But more importantly for us, this is, there's going to be, people are going to have to think wisely, seriously, and make sure they've got builders that are strong, not only on paper, but in material stockpile, because it's going to get harder and it's going to get more costly to moving forward.
Absolutely. And what about the fallout then for the local WeChat chats? How does that play out, given what we've just heard?
Well, the local WeChat chat of the investment groups, the majority of them just basically saying they're just pulling any interest that they would have otherwise had in Chinese companies in terms of shares. They're just pulling it out because the way they see it is it's only a downward trend based on this Commonwealth policy that Xi is implementing now. The state-owned or state interest in private enterprise, which is really to control. Look, it's that's one of the things. Locally, there's greater focus on local property and putting that money that they would have otherwise put into shares abroad and so forth. They're just going to, for them, it's steady as she goes, and keeping an eye on the market and being in the market to see what how the money's going to work better for them. But one thing for sure is that they're still not interested in opening up any businesses as they were before, local businesses, that is. And you see evidence of that in when you go to a lot of the suburbs in Sydney where they had that. The Chinese cuisine was very influential. Unless it's a real strong hub, there's a lot of places that are just remaining closed, and we're not going to have the broader spectrum of Chinese cuisine throughout Sydney like we had before. But look, the WeChat chatter groups here are very strong. As I shared last week, the two, Dusty and Evan, they joined two of the trader chat groups, and they're very robust, Martin. They've got us out of trouble for one of our clients. We needed to, help them sheet two bedrooms and entire bedrooms and the ceilings, and were able to source labour through that. It's an interesting scenario with the trades, how you have to persuade the tradespeople to come and work with you. You're competing with people that. To a lot of them, it's not so much how much you can give them by way of cash in hand, but it's also they're being offered food for the whole day. They'd be also being offered being picked up from home and dropped off from home in order to get them to work for at the different job sites. And look, we've trumped a couple of those those because Dustin have been offered fresh eggs, and omelets and bok choy from the veggie gardens. So that's how we got them across the job for us.
Yeah, very impressive. Well, it just goes to show those fresh eggs and veggies were always going to be worth something. So all power to the railway, I guess. But now let's talk about the block, because of course we had the finale, last evening. And I had a phone call this morning from a journo who was writing for one of the newspapers, and he said, "What can I learn about property from the block?" And I said, "Nothing, because it's nothing to do with real property. It's all to do with, showmanship and theatre and et cetera, et cetera. So don't read anything important into it."
No, I think there's the story that, the slide that you put up, and people can go read the story. I'll tell you what the real story is, Mark. The real story is what Tarek put up. That's a real story, in my view, and it just embodies the skepticism around auctions and what people are either say on certain forums, they talk about it on Twitter, but most of the people internalize, and that's the skepticism around auctions and how the auctions the auction process has been hijacked, and pretty much got hijacked in the mid 90s, and how the whole system has been abused. So for me, when I saw that the post that Tarek put up, it just that was to me that's it. That's the real story as to the story that should be reported on, and you take it from there. The fact that the buyers, who are the buyers that are being represented, all the shenanigans that go behind it, all the marketing. Well, in this case, obviously, it's all staged, and the marketing they've got very, very deep pockets. But the parallel is with a lot of auctions in the marketing campaigns, like real estate agents, in a typical private treaty campaign. The only difference really is, in terms of the marketing, is the fact that you have to pay $800 to somebody, $700 to $800 to somebody to come and call the auction, and it's a licensed real estate agent. That, in my view, it's a very, very grey area, because if you're going to be representing the sale of a property, you're meant to inspect the property before you take charge of that sale. Mm. And I can tell you now, Martin, 99% of auctioneers do not visit the property before the day. They actually visit it on the day, and you're paying these people to spruik the property when they haven't even walked into it a day before or a week prior or anything, in order to get the feel of it. They just basically do it minutes beforehand, because why? They're also tied up with 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 other auctions throughout the day. So you're really not going to get the best outcome in my view.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, a lot of people, of course, are lured into the auction route, as you said before, because, of course, the agents may make a bit more because you get extra marketing budget. But the whole thing at the moment seems to me a bit off key. And, so one of the properties went for, considerably higher. But as we've said before, the properties are still selling, and in some cases they're selling above what you might expect, because there was a particular reason why that's the case. But you can't extrapolate from that to the broader market, just as much as you can't necessarily extrapolate from two not selling and getting passed in. I mean, it really is just nonsense to try and actually extrapolate the whole of the market from what happened on the block. And I would remind you again that the TV channel is somewhat connected with the real estate portals. So, of course, they're being totally objective in the way they report it, aren't they?
Well, of course. And look, the thing is, I put out that tweet also on that thread with regards to the, before I even got any notion of what happened with the auction at the block, I put out the tweet, I think it was Saturday, said, before people start losing their marbles and salivating at auction clearance rates, compare the sale by auction to open house private treaty sales.
Yep.
Around the same time, out of lockdown in 2021, and I put the snapshot of 2020, 2020, 2021, and last Saturday's numbers that actually went to auction in New South Wales, but the open houses, we had 608 properties that went to auction across New South Wales, the majority of them being in Sydney, in the Sydney region. But there was 21,914 open houses, Martin. So, and people make a big deal out of sale by auction. Why? Because it sells newspapers, it sells a story, it sells advertising time, and so forth. And it was after that, the day after that, I read Tarek's tweet, and I started thinking as to the reality. That is reality. Now this is where the rubber meets the road, and this is why people have got to understand. We are in a real market now, where agents actually have to work a little bit more for their bread and butter, as opposed to just throwing anything online and getting the sale and then beating the chest because they got over reserve or they got more than what the vendors expected. I mean, even John McGrath said it, in good times, all you need is a piece of cardboard, and you scribble a phone number on it and notify the passers-by that the property's for sale, and you get a good outcome. So, but look at when and why auctions should be adopted. By Jack.
Yeah, but I think it's really worth unpacking that slightly, right? Because obviously there are some situations where an auction makes sense. So, for example, if there's a court order, presumably you have to think about an auction. I suppose if there's a specific dispute or something like that. But actually, there aren't really that many reasons why an auction makes sense, is there?
No, look, I've always been... I haven't been an advocate of auctions in my sales days. I've always believed that you achieve a greater outcome with by private treaty and allowing people to have the time to internalize more so what's going on in the property rather than pressing and pushing them for an outcome and believing that that's the best result. Look, another Neil Jenman is basically sits in the same camp. And there are a couple others as well. That we sit in the same camp, but that we don't believe that the auction campaign is the best. A court order is one that one of the reasons being is because the judges and magistrates believe at the end of the day that is the price on the day. That's what people are going to pay, and there's no recourse from that, so there's no disputes. It's believed to be transparent and open, and that's the best form of a way to settle whether it be a divorce, a deceased estate, any type of dispute. And obviously, there are other when companies are being dissolved or when siblings or friends that have got share ownership in a property, they want to settle the price, and minimise any disputes among the beneficiaries. Well, that's basically goes along more or less with the court orders. Then you've got your mortgagee sales. Although the ones that I've attended late are being passed in because even the mortgagees, even the banks are greedy, and they think they can get more, and they feel that there's we've got a rebound. So mortgagee sales, they take this option, Martin, because it reduces recourse on the person that they've taken, or the company, or the individual that they've taken the property from, away from, and from future litigation. By them saying you didn't do your best, you didn't achieve the best price. So this nullifies any comebacks, future litigation. Then, of course, you've got your unique property where you genuinely don't have comparable sales. I ask you, Martin, how many properties around your neighbourhood could you honestly say that are unique.
Mm. Yeah, not that many, but a few. There are a few.
Yeah, but how many agents push for that auction campaign sale because they're telling the vendors or potential vendors, oh, your property is unique. Listen here, Dipstick. Yeah, there's nothing unique about the majority of the properties in Sydney. You do a comparison, you have the value of the land, construction inclusions, depreciation and all that, yeah, as the valuers do in order to come to a reasonable value, as they appraise property on behalf of the banks. Most of the properties have been built by, in neighbourhoods, have been built by, three or four different builders, over the years. So, unless it's very unique, that's your option. But look, I think the two real reasons that apart from the main reason is obviously a quick sale that vendors want a quick sale as well to settle. Okay, that's to me that's you could say yeah okay let's go through an auction, let's do an auction campaign, just put a bit of urgency in people to make a decision. But you're not in my opinion, you're still not going to get the best result, right? If vendors want a quick sale. But the real reason in my books as to that trumps everything else is, and this is why the agents have hijacked the process, is the fact that the agents get a quicker sale and therefore they make a quicker commission to put in the bank.
Yep. Absolutely. I've seen that many times, many, many times. And when you actually ask the vendor subsequent, so why did you go for auction? I said, well, we're not quite sure, really. Quite often they sort of shake their heads and think, well, it just sort of happened,
Yeah, because the agent told them it was the best way to do it. Oh, you can sell the property before the auction. You can sell the property at the auction. You can sell the property after the auction. And that trumps private. Hold on. So you're telling me that private treaty only has one day that you can sell the property and that's it, and after that you can't sell your property? The same shit. <Yeah. did.
laughs> Absolutely. And then, of course, you've got the old issue of the underquoting, which is sort of a way of trying to pull forward more people, and then maybe you've got the misleading behaviour and, there's a bunch of things that are there below the surface, right, which probably in an auction context is more manipulable. And that's the other thing I think that's probably worth thinking about.
Even going back to the televised to the block, right?
Mm.
I'm sure people are still baffled as to what happened.
Mm.
And not knowing who the buyers are. Yeah, I mean, it just really highlighted a lot of this, the shenanigans that go on, and the pressure that auctioneers try to put on the people on the day.
Yep.
Yeah, and so forth. Yeah, look, I think it's going to be, auctions are moving forward. I keep on shouting it, from the rooftops every time I can, when I can. Yeah, just sometimes you get sick and tired of it. But the Fair Trade in New South Wales need to do a lot more, because months ago I said that as the market tightens up, as the market slows down or starts taking a downward trend, underquoting will become more and more prolific unless the authorities really step out. People think that the authorities are the real estate institutes. They're not. As a matter of fact, the real estate institutes promote auction, and I've challenged the CEOs, many of them, and I challenged many of the presidents to name and shame the ones that the ones in their organisation that are underquoting, and they won't, because the main franchises actually have manuals that teach agents how to price it low to watch it go.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll keep banging that drum, and certainly anybody thinking of selling their property, don't jump immediately to the auction. There are many reasons why. Maybe there are other routes. Now, we should just talk about this other one, because the other thing, of course, is now mortgage delinquencies is sort of a bit of a thing. There are more forced sales than there were, as we've covered before, and interest rates are continuing to go higher. Now, of course, Westpac came out and said, well, we're not seeing anything yet. Well, you wouldn't see anything yet, right? Because it takes quite a long time for the mortgage delinquency process to show up in any of the numbers. And they're also, of course, doing something else, Edward, and that is they are actually encouraging people to sell their property before they actually start any issues with regard to being delinquent or anything else like that. That's the path that they're actually running at the moment. So I would expect to see low levels of delinquencies and low levels of mortgagee in possession sales, because effectively the banks are actually being very proactive in finding people who probably won't be able to afford and actually getting them to put their property in the market.
Yeah, the actual pressure and the stigma behind falling into delinquency and then going into mortgagee in possession, I think is more overwhelming to people, and therefore they would prefer to to take the option whilst the banks are gently coercing them to sell before the market continues to to drop. I think that pressure is what the mainstream perhaps, and we know that they won't talk about it.
No, they won't. Yep.
Because they want to talk about these airy-fairy numbers.
Yep.
Because that pressure is what creates endemic issues with in society.
Mm.
Because that pressure, adds to family breakdowns, adds to sickness, adds to all sorts of other issues that are borne by the rest of society, and that's and so I guess I don't believe we're going to see huge numbers of mortgagee in possession sales.
Mm.
Because, as you say, a lot of people have been coerced and being encouraged to sell prior, and this is where we're going to see a continual rise in listing numbers. And we're not going to know the background story unless you talk to the agents like we do and like our team does, and we get all this information. And this is the thing. So if people can understand that from mortgage stress to delinquency and to mortgagee in possession could be anywhere between 2.5, 3, 4 years.
Yep.
And look, and even then, Martin, you can drag that process out a lot longer as well.
Absolutely.
If you're able to put up with that stigma of your family, your friends, your neighbors knowing that you're under that financial pressure. But most people would decide to jump a lot earlier.
Well, it's interesting because I've had a few people reach for me and basically pick my brains a little bit about the situation that they're in. And the story goes pretty much similarly. We got a big mortgage. The interest rates are already going up. We know that we're going to have difficulty ahead. We've spoken to the bank. The bank basically said, well, your income's fundamentally changed. Not a lot we can do. So probably you should be thinking about putting your property on the market sooner rather than later, because if you leave it, then property prices are going to fall. That means you're not going to actually get so much equity out of it. That means that you're going to be in more difficulty with regard to paying the mortgage. So you should start activating that sales plan now. We'll give you a little bit of latitude on the repayments for 3 months or so to get yourself, give yourself a little bit of wriggle room. But that's about all we can do. So that's the sort of line that is being propagated. And it's not just one or two banks. It's a number of banks. And it's not just just a few people. Quite a few people are now having those conversations. Now, obviously, there'll be differences. But going down the delinquency route and the forced sale route, the banks don't want to do that because they get huge bad PR. And it takes a hell of a time to do. Whereas this route essentially puts all the acid back on the individual mortgage holder. And, effectively, if they're successful in selling the property, the bank will be able to walk away with the paid down mortgage, which means that essentially they don't have any issue on their books. So you can sort of understand why they do it. The question is, what are the social consequences of that, as you say, in terms of the pressure on those households, and where are they going to go, and, you know, are they going to be able to rent? And I mean, there's a bunch of what if questions that follow, but that's the way it's playing out at the moment. So I agree with you. I don't think we're going to see a massive hike in delinquencies in the short term, at least. Later, maybe more, but the amount of pressure in the system, a number of people begin to struggle, is just rising. And therefore, I expect to see more listings ahead.
Yeah, look, definitely. And this is a lot of the telltale signs are there when you start seeing a lot more people that you talk to in general. You start hearing how they're taking the kids out from private schools into public schools. The second, third or fourth cars, whatever, the spare cars, extra cars are being put on the market for sale in order to be able to stay in the neighborhood that they want to stay. So all these other options that people got, that will start, obviously, as I say, they'll start selling their toys, in order to protect their principal place of residence. But sooner than later, it just gets to be too big. And then you've got the other side where the mainstream media are going to be pushing. I'm going to be hearing it sooner than later. And that is, the rates will start coming down, at the end of 2023 and blah, blah, blah. So people are going to want to try and hold on. It's like watching people drown, trying to hold on to that last bit of, that piece of foam that's floating past. And you think that that's going to save you, and you've got another 170 miles to go before you hit shore. It's sad. It's sad, mate, and you see it over and over again. But as I said, we just keep an eye on the numbers and watch the areas where the numbers are starting to rise, and where people just they can't hold on any longer. And it's typically the ones that we're seeing from our point of view, not necessarily mainstream or the positions the mainstream economists and property commentators take, but the one from our grassroots levels, we see the areas that are more under stress, and which they correlate a lot more with your surveys, and that is typically where the people have jumped in prematurely on the promises of government of the first home buyers grants and policies, and when the governments were pushing for first time buyers to get in. They're the ones that are suffering the most, as well as in anywhere between your 2.5 to 3 million bracket. There seems to be a bit of pain there as well.
Yep, that's right. Plus a few investors who've got multiple properties that are not performing well. Well, let's talk about the numbers briefly. It is quite an interesting story, I think, at the moment. So if we start with Sydney and we go back to the 31st of October, there were 18,679 in Sydney. If we jump forward to the third, it was 19,162, the mix of houses and apartments, roughly similar. And on the 7th, it's dropped back slightly.
Yeah, because these are obviously the sales that occur over the week, over the weekend, and Monday, early Tuesday is when you get your properties that are sold taken off the portals. The interesting thing, as we say, is that you look at the best count for where we'll be tracking is around about 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, between 8 and 9 p.m. on a Thursday night is where you see most of the properties. Up to then is where you see most of the properties that are going to be that are on market to come up. Now, what I have been noticed last week, I noticed there was a few stragglers that came in morning of Friday. Not as many, but it's I get the feeling that it's a late spring. Because we are seeing a bit more come on than before, and it's the changeover. Obviously, I'm just sharing these slides from Domain, but we've got other sources where we can actually see the new listings that come on. Apart from tracking, the numbers in different suburbs, but there are other ways where we can actually see how many more new listings are coming on, as opposed to also, and I think Square Meet SQM have that, and that's a great source as well, where you can actually get a better idea of how many are lagging on market, haven't come off market, and then they come back on. So we don't consider that as a new listing. It's a rebound marketing campaign, because in times like this, you get good, it ends up being a a 30-day, 60, 90-day campaign. Then the agent loses the listing. It goes into a cool off for about 2 weeks and then comes back on live again with another agent, and they try to twig the marketing to make it look new, because otherwise people start realizing that it's a stale listing.
Absolutely. And we also touched on it before, but just to show the numbers now, this is actually the auctions versus open for inspection for the 12th of November. And, look at the relative distribution between auctions and open for inspection. As you can see, as you said, Edwin, really focusing on auctions doesn't make a lot of sense when you've got way more open for inspection.
No, and this is just the Monday's figures. By Saturday, The lower number there of 4,182 open for inspections that are being noted down on the portals will actually grow, and they'll be closer to 22,000. So when you've got 747 planned auctions, we'll probably end up with about 680 because a lot of these will fall off. Possibly you'll only end up with about 650 on the actual day. So I'll try to do a screenshot again and put up on my Twitter feed on the Saturday and give you the real numbers on the actual day of the auction as to how many are going to go to auction in New South Wales on a Saturday and how many open for inspections are listed there. And I'd say we're going to be in the low 600s that will actually go to, to the full term and be actually be presented to auction on the day of Saturday, but I dare say it's going to be about 22,000 or thereabouts for open house inspection. So that's again, but we bring them on and we share about them because it's the thing to do.
Yeah, well, no, it's interesting, and the interesting, fascinating thing to me is how often they'll run up towards the auction and then make a decision to pull a couple of days beforehand, right? Funny that.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Let's look at Melbourne, because we've got some data there. So on the 31st of October, 24,926, and then on the 3rd of November, 25,414. And if we go ahead again to the 7th, we're now at 25,283, 25,283. So pretty strong trend again.
Look, this is a little bit different to Sydney, right? So what even by these screenshots from Domain, what it's telling us is that less sales are occurring, more listings are staying on market, and that number will potentially grow to be 26,000 by Thursday night. So listings in Melbourne, which you mentioned a week or two ago, you've been mentioning the fact that with your surveys, you're also seeing that trend. It's that upward trend of properties going to market, or people also intending to sell more so in Melbourne than they are in Sydney. So this is the numbers don't lie, and it's not like I make this shit up. So it's
a consistent pattern. Absolutely.
It's getting a lot stronger. But then, look, historically, in the last two cycles, I've seen the same thing. Melbourne lags in the prices going up, then it overtakes Sydney somewhat, but it's generally the first to drop. Admittedly, in previous cycles, Perth is the one that's dropped the quickest and the hardest. In previous cycles, this one's a little bit seems to be a little bit stronger. Then again, you look at the price points, the entry point, and working from home has made it a lot more attractive. And also the rental numbers that people that they're pulling over there make it interesting for eastern side investors to park their money over there. So but we'll wait and see what happens.
Two quick points. Perth, in that earlier Westpac slide, it was interesting that delinquencies are still higher in the West even now. They meant to have had a really good boom over the last little while, but delinquencies are still higher. The second point is that We know that there are a lot of forced sales in and around Victoria that we're seeing in our surveys. So again, it goes back to this point of when I say forced sales, I don't mean by the bank. I mean people actually making the decision to hop out. And that's one of the reasons why the numbers, I think, are so high. But if we go to Brisbane, this is quite interesting too, because Brisbane is a life of its own. 31st of October, 5770 properties. On the 3rd of November, 5843. And on the 7th, 5780. So a little bit of wobbling around. But what I do notice in the Brisbane market is how far prices are falling now. In fact, I've done an anti-spruik today to the west of Brisbane, looking at the areas around Ipswich. Very significant falls there. And in fact, CoreLogic reported that the falls in and around Brisbane were more significant the last month than Sydney or Melbourne. So it's all quite consistent. There's definitely a cooling of the market, and there's still a lot of property hanging around. The sales momentum is very weak.
Yeah, I think and again, you've got to understand the landscape of your Ipswiches and your Logans and all this, and you've got to look at the demographics as well. Two decades ago, I was very interested in those regions. From a personal investment point of view, as well as helping clients. But that was two decades ago. But the same stories keep on.
It's the same old, Edwin. And interestingly, the yields on investment properties in and around Queensland are still higher. They're worst in Victoria. They're pretty bad in New South Wales. They're somewhat higher in Queensland even now. But again, I'm noticing in my surveys, more property investors in Queensland are having to put the red flag up and saying, I can't cope with this anymore. Why? Because whilst the gross and net investment yields are a bit better, with the rise in interest rates, they can't put the rent up sufficient to cover the incremental costs. So that's why we're seeing more investment properties in and around Brisbane in particular coming on the market. So expect to see more of that, I think. It's the same old, same old.
Yeah, and look, the traditional investors in your Queenslanders and in your WAs are from the New South Wales and Victoria, and again we go back to what the WeChat chatters often talk about is the ceiling of rents that your typical real estate agent can charge for a property in these particular suburbs, your Ipswiches or your your outer suburbs of Perth and so forth. There's a ceiling on rent, but when you start talking about parts of Sydney and how those rents you break those ceilings, you can't do that through your normal channels where you're an investor in one state and you own the property in another state, because the people that are managing the property are professional licensed people, and they're not going to go out there and play silly buggers with the market because they'll lose their licenses.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why you see those fundamental changes, and that's why the pressure, your WAs and your Queenslands and all that will start dropping very, very hard because of the pain that your Sydney-siders and your Melbourneites investors moved north and moved west to invest. But once they start feeling pain here, then obviously, as I say, you get rid of your toys first, then you get rid of your holiday homes, and you get rid of your investment properties and so forth in order to protect your principal place of residence. But it's deja vu as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely, deja vu all over again. Okay, and so now what's more wacky than a conspiracy theory is who on earth bought that Granville property?
Well, look, here's the gentleman that bought it. I obviously, for privacy reasons, I couldn't take the full shot. But for a bit of background, this gentleman, anybody can dress the way they want to dress, and they can present the way they want to present. Yeah, that's not neither here nor there. But the interesting thing, Martin, is the story behind it. So I was speaking with one of the agents there. This gentleman made an inquiry on the property only an hour or two before the auction. So as far as the agent was concerned, that was the first introduction to the property. the gentleman that bought it, he didn't even know where South Granville was. Now this is from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
some of our viewers may say from the donkey's mouth. be gentle. This is from the horse's mouth. The father didn't know where South Granville was. So you've got to ask yourself, why did he buy it for?
Yep.
Now I can tell you, and overhearing what from the conversation, doing a bit of eavesdropping, is that this fellow was from Marrickville. The mind boggles as to why you're living Marrickville, you don't know where South Granville is, and you want to buy a decommissioned substation, in Whoop Whoop, as far as you're concerned, geographically from Marrickville, from the inner west to your, you can't even say that the demographics of the communities are the same because it's chalk and cheese.
Yep.
Right. So the question is, and I'll get to the bottom of it, and hopefully, and I will be able to share it as to why did he buy it. I've got my own theories, and it's a conspiracy. He needed a bunker because North Korea's shooting missiles over Japan. We have three or so bombers that can carry a nuclear arsenal flying in from the US very soon into Australia. All sorts of shit happening, Martin. So I'd say that was the next best thing to a nuclear bunker. I don't know. That's just my theory.
Well, it's certainly well built, which could be quite useful, I suppose, in that situation. But it is interesting, isn't it? You don't know where Granville is. You turn up an hour before, and then you basically buy it. Well,
yeah. Hey-ho. So he, as far as the agent was concerned, his inquiry on the property was an hour or two just before the auction.
Yeah.
So now this is the thing. Now, from a line side of things, you would have to have the cash to buy this, put it out. The banks, the bank is really not going to lend you on this. And this is from speaking with the builder, right? So speaking with the builder that I met there at the auction, and I saw his elaborate design for what he wanted to build, but he pulled away at his high speed was 325. He pulled away. And but speaking with him, and as he said, you got to buy this thing. You got to buy this thing in cash. The bank won't lend you on it at all because it's too prickly.
Yeah.
So that's the wacky world of property in New South Wales, mate.
Fascinating. Well, before we go, tip of the week, and actually, this is to do with the old conveyancing trick, isn't it?
Look, it is. I think tip of the week is be conscious of the fact that we're leading up to Christmas, and conveyancers and solicitors typically conveyancing firms and solicitors' offices, they take a break from about 22nd, 23rd of December, and they don't get back to work till the 16th, 17th of January. So if you're looking at your typical conveyance would take 42 days, or when you buy a property to settle, it's about 6 weeks settlement. It's on the front page of the contract. That's typical. So you can do one of two things. You can settle earlier because if you say exchange on a contract today or tomorrow, I think 6 weeks takes you up to about the 19th of December. So you're kind of very close. So then you can settle earlier, or you can delay the settlement. In both parties obviously need to discuss that. The key is, Martin, is to if you really want to sell and you want to stay on market, or you want to stay in the market to buy, or if you want to stay on market to sell, pick a solicitor or a conveyancer that's going to take your calls and your emails, and it's going to help you make decisions during this period. I can tell you now, 90% of conveyancers and solicitors, they literally will shut shop. Yep. For the end of the year. And this is where this is, in my view, this is where you can take advantage of the situation if you are a buyer, and if you've got somebody, you've got a team behind you that will support you, because that could be the difference between getting something at the right price that you want because you want to buy, you have to buy, but also if you want to sell, again, same rule applies. Get somebody that's going to be friendly and that's going to help you along the way, and it's going to be at an email away or a phone call away.
Yeah, very good advice, Edwin. And I've heard a few horror stories where the conveyance has gone off just before Christmas and popped back at the end of January and says, oh, hello. Oh, yeah, didn't I tell you I was going on holiday?
It can be very costly. It can be very costly.
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, if you've got an intersected transaction and you're trying to do something else as well, it can be huge. And it's also worth remembering that, of course, a lot of the banks also are on skeleton staff over that same period. So if you're trying to get a mortgage through, again, you've got to allow a lot of extra time. Just be careful over this rather wobbly time for the next couple of months. By the end of January, we're back to normal, eh?
Back to normal. Can we say that anything is but normal now?
No, that's why I said it, Edwin. very good. Well, thank you once again. Great advice there. Very important information. And as always, you put your finger right on the critical issue to think about. So thanks, and we'll do it all again next week, eh?
Definitely. All the best.
See ya. Bye-bye.